Hello.
Greg, happy holidays.
Hello,
you.
Bill. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Good to talk to you again.
Good. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you. Hope your new puppy isn't soiling your rug too much.
The Valentino boy. It's amazing. You know, I had a Dalmatian for the last, 14 years. We had him, and he died a couple of years ago. And it was so... I grieved so hard, I never got over it for 2 years. And I probably never will actually get over it. You know, it really was a loss. It was bigger than really any human loss I've ever experienced, you know. And I never thought I would have another Dalmatian. And one day I was driving along in my car, and I used to look in the mirror, and he would always be sitting in the back of, I've got a Range Rover, and he'd be sitting in the back of the Range Rover, you know. And I'd look in the mirror, and I'd always see him, you know. And one day I looked in the mirror, and I thought I saw him. And I thought, oh, you know, maybe I should have another one. And that was the start of it. And, of course, when you get near the puppies, that's all game, set, and match.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's done. I know what you mean. Yeah, we had a dog very much like that. It was a different breed, a golden retriever mix.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful.
Oh, lovely dog. And we went to the local animal shelter to pick up a small dog.
Yeah.
Because we'd had enough of the big dogs and all that came with it.
Yeah.
And we ended up with a St. Bernard mix.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. But they are such characters. And they weave their way into your lives. And they become as close, if not closer, than a lot of human beings.
I've never been betrayed by a dog.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And when you come home late, they don't give you a bollocking.
That's true. They're happy to see you no matter what.
Correct. Correct.
Well, very good.
Yeah.
Let's see. I enjoyed your web chat Sunday. I've participated in the two in 2009 also.
Yeah, good, good. Thank you.
And it's just great fun. I don't recall anyone else doing web chats like this.
I don't know. Do you know something? It was Ellie that started me on this, you know, with her sort of her high-tech thing. And, you know, why don't you do a web chat? Oh, yeah, okay, let's do one. And, of course, when I set it up, the first attempt was an absolute disaster because, I mean, there were so many people who wanted to get in the chat room. The whole thing crashed.
I remember that.
The whole thing crashed. And so we had to reset all the technology. But now it's working pretty good. And, you know, the only problem now is that I could probably stay on there for 10 hours talking. You know, I can only go for so long and then I have to stop, you know.
Well, you were on...
But it is lovely. What's lovely about it is I get to talk to people from all over the world. And they ask, some of them, of course, really silly questions, but some of them are actually quite deep and meaningful.
Well, I was kind of jealous on some of the questions that they asked. Dang it, I wish I would have thought of that for the interview.
I know, yeah. Well, it is incredible. And one of the things I get from it is, you know, are you going to play this song? I've always wanted you to hear you play that song. You know, and it tells me a lot about what the audience wants and what they expect to see and what, you know, what their feelings are.
Right.
So I get a lot from it. It's very nice to be able to communicate directly with people. And at the end of the day, it's good promotion.
Very good. Well, bless Ellie's heart.
Bless Ellie for it, yeah.
That was a genius idea. Yeah, I noticed it went much more smoothly than the initial one in 2009. Couple little hiccups now and there, but all in all... And you went on till what, after midnight your time?
Yes. I started at around 9 and I finished about 12:30.
Wow.
But you know, it's not hard. You just sit there typing it out, but you know, one question comes after the other and it's quite a pleasurable experience. It's just, you know, like anything, after 3 or 4 hours of typing at a keyboard, you just get, your eyes get tired and your brain gets tired and you can't do anymore. But you know what? I'm going to use it more in the future, especially with this new show, Songs of a Lifetime. I'm going to start to use it at the shows, and do small web chats, maybe live on stage, that kind of thing.
Interesting.
You know, get and use Skype and get people into the venue, and all of that kind of thing. There's amazing possibilities with it.
Well, since you mentioned Songs of a Lifetime, that's going to be your world tour next year.
Yes.
And you're still firming up locations, is that right?
We're booking shows every day, all the time. Oh, good. So Valentino has now come to join me.
Oh, very good. So Songs of a Lifetime sounds pretty self-explanatory.
Well, it is. Well, it is. I mean, it's just really what I've done is I've written a. I mean, I don't want this to sound high-minded, really, but I've written an autobiography, and of my life, and I wanted to do a tour to coincide with that, and because it's a very personal thing, I thought of the best way to do it was to do it alone, and to play the songs that meant a lot to me. Throughout my lifetime, you know, and not only that I'd written, but things that had meant a lot to me.
So,
you know, that had some meaning or influence upon me. Well, it'll be mainly the songs that I've written, because they were mainly the things in my life that were important. But along the way, there were other things that influenced me, that steered me into being who I am, really, you know, and I think that as part of the autobiography, they are important, at least to me. And if anybody, you know, if anybody really is a big fan of King Crimson or of ELP, they should find it interesting. Because what it does is, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. It all fits together in the end.
Right.
And I hope that what Songs of a Lifetime is a personal witnessing of that jigsaw puzzle going together.
Gosh, that sounds exciting to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just, I think it's interesting. I think that, it probably, if you weren't into King Crimson or ELP, you may very well be bored by it. However, if you like the music of King Crimson and you like the music of ELP, it'll probably be quite a fascinating show. And, you know, I'll tell a few stories. There will be a few times for the audience, if they want to ask questions about, you know, how it happened, why it happened, things that happened, there will be that too. So in the end, it'll be a bit of a shared experience. But, you know, as an entertainer, I never forget that what it is a show. I'm there to entertain people, and, so it won't be just a boring account of my life. It will be a performance, but the fabric of it will be the autobiography.
Right, and of course, if you're not a King Crimson or ELP fan, what are you doing sitting there?
What are you doing sitting there, probably, you know? Unless you're bored, you've got nothing to do, and in which case, I hope to convert you.
Right.
Well, it's true, you know. I get people come up sometimes. You know, they come up and they say, I mean, we did, ELP played a show a couple of years ago here in London, and some people came along to that out of curiosity, but had never seen the band, you know. I say, shit, I never realised you were as good as that, you know. I just said, because they'd never been exposed to it. They'd never seen or heard ELP, not even on record. They just knew the name. And they went to see the band just because it was a name that was legendary. And they thought, oh, we'll go and see that. That could be something, you know.
And this is the High Voltage Festival?
Yeah, that was the High Voltage Festival.
Yeah, I've just rewatched the DVD on that. I was surprised at how young the audience seemed to be.
They were quite young. A lot of them, of course, had never seen the band, but they'd got the records. And it was just a chance for them to see that legendary name and, you know, probably the last chance to see it.
Right.
It was a very emotional show, actually. You know, people backstage were crying. I mean, it was very strange to be backstage in that show. There were so many people, like, emotionally, not upset in a way, but reliving their youth, you know?
Right.
Because, in a way, we had not performed for so long that it was just that quick flash of going back to the 70s.
Would have been, what, a dozen years or so?
Certainly since we played in England, probably more. You know, at least that. And for many people, they would have only seen us, you know, 40 years ago.
Well, I know, well, 40 years ago, your first, and we talked about this before, was you did pictures at the Isle of Wight.
Yeah.
And then the High Voltage Festival, you talked about people being emotionally moved. I have to admit, I shed a tear of nostalgia and just kind of epiphany when you did the Sage.
You're very, very kind. It's very kind to say so. But yes, that is the sort of moment that, you know, it's very poignant. It's a very poignant moment. It's very exposed and very meaningful for a lot of people because it was that moment they were sat in silence, which was very unusual in those days. You know, you normally, if you went to see any band, you went to see Hendrix or The Who or The Rolling Stones or Jethro Tull, there would never be a moment that was absolutely silent, you know.
Right.
Far less would you see a complete symphonic work performed, you know, by a rock and roll band. That was really unusual. And so it was a really strange experience for them on the day. But of course, in retrospect, now you have classical music on your cell phone.
Right.
But you probably wouldn't have had that, or maybe you would, but you wouldn't have had it so quickly had it not been for ELP opening up the classical musical world with pictures at an exhibition.
Now, how did that come about? That seemed like such a gutsy move.
It was a piece of music that originally Keith had brought it in. He was playing the piano score to it. And he liked it. And we started to play it as a band for fun. It was never intended to be a record or anything. We played it in the rehearsal room just for our own amusement. And every time we rehearsed, we got a bit more of it off. And each time we played a bit more and a bit more and a bit more, until in the end, one day, I can't remember where it was, but maybe it wasn't Newcastle because we recorded it there, but it was before that. We started to play it on the shows just for fun. You know, during the improvisation, we'd start doing pictures, you know, and people loved it. They loved it.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, then we said, well, wait a minute. This is going down really well. Why don't we do it? Why don't we actually do it in and of itself? And that's what we did.
Yeah, it's one of those things that really had a huge impact on my life, and it helped me get an A in a class in college also.
Very good. Well, it's strange, you know. That sort of bridging of classical music and rock music, you know, stroke popular music, pop music, opened a door for a lot of music teachers to be able to talk to young people about music instead of it looking boring and dry and Beethoven and Tchaikovsky, you know, and it looked like a world away from anything they knew, you know. Now they were able to bridge that gap and say, but look, here's one of your bands. Here's a band from your generation playing the music of Mussorgsky.
Exactly.
And that was like a bridge academically, so that it opened up the door really to classical music for a lot of young people who hitherto, before that, It was a closed door for the elite, for them what knows, you know, for the intelligentsia.
Right.
You know, if you weren't a smart, university-educated person, the door to classical music was shut to you. After ELP performed, the door was open and you could come in.
Amen. Well, I was thrilled to do it, too. It changed. I don't want to say it was, you know, a totally life-changing experience. That would be overblown a bit.
Yeah.
But it did open, like you said, the doorway to appreciate, for me to appreciate all types of music that I never would have considered.
Well, after that came opera, you know, Pavarotti, many. In fact, when we released Pictures at an Exhibition, the sales of the orchestral versions quadrupled. Think about that. The sales of the original orchestral versions quadrupled.
I know I bought one.
Yeah, a lot of people did, because they heard the band do it, and they thought, I really like that piece of music. I'll get the proper orchestral version. So they went out, and they got the, you know, wherever it was, the Berlin Philharmonic, with Von Karajan, and they bought that version. And so, you know, and then from there, once they'd done that, the next piece of classical music wasn't a problem. Then they would go out and get, you know, Bach's Fugue or this and that, and all of a sudden they had a classical music collection building in their own home.
Exactly right. And then you kept exposing us to Copland and Ginastera and kicking the door open some more for us.
Well, that's right, because once we realized that it was a good thing, then what we did is we tried to make sure that on each of our albums there was a component that was some of that. We injected some of that into our entire trajectory. That was it. We did a bit on each album.
Well, just on a personal note, I thank you for that. It enriched me more than I can tell. I really appreciate it.
And it enriched us. You know, the incredible thing about that era, Bill, is that it wasn't a question of us being teachers or leaders or pioneers even. We were learning as you were learning. It was a shared experience.
Mm.
We were learning as everyone else was learning. We were young too, and we were learning things, and that's why we were quite brave, because it wasn't a foregone conclusion that we wouldn't get mud slung in our face. And we did, on occasions, get accused quite often of being pretentious and overblown and, you know, who do they think they are?
Right.
It didn't come without damage. And so, but it was a learning curve for us. And what we were doing is we had enough guts to put it out there and expose it publicly.
I don't know of any great thing that's ever come along without risk and ridicule.
I think there is some truth in that. And that is, if you really want to be, you know, making your mark, there has to be a degree of risk and originality. And if you look at any of the great bands, you know, to a certain extent, they trod that line with the skill of a mountain goat. You know, it was touch and go for any of them, whether they would be accepted or ridiculed.
This Friday, you're meeting with one of those greats, my buddy Ian Anderson.
Yes.
In Salisbury Cathedral.
Yeah, we're playing the cathedral in Salisbury. And last year we did Canterbury Cathedral together.
Mm-hmm.
I've known Ian for many years. We're friends. And, of course, he was one of those pioneers.
Indeed.
Who just opened a doorway that was all his. And it's you know, he's a phenomenon. And I have the highest respect for him.
Well, I enjoy his latest little blurb. He's an acoustic performer with a lot of noisy friends.
Well, there you go. I mean, you know, he's a lot of things to a lot of people, Ian, but he's a great, inventive, original spirit, you know, and an extremely nice person.
Oh, indeed.
You know, he's one of the real characters of music, of the late 20th century. And, you know, when you think of Jimi Hendrix and when you think of The Who, and when you think of those colorful people, Ian Anderson is one of them.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, he's one of a kind. I have some good experiences with Ian, and I just love the man.
Yeah.
I recently got the Seeing Sun, the Mary Saul CD from Puerto Rico.
Oh, yeah.
I was really surprised because it's from the early 70s, outdoor music festival, so much can go wrong. The audio quality is so good on that.
Yes, it was one of the early festivals where they had become aware of the importance of the festival. You know, I believe Woodstock had happened by then. And they knew that it was going to be a historic event, and they took the trouble to record it properly.
And the band, you sounded like you were on the top of your game, and a lot of songs, there's different renditions I'd never heard before.
Well, all of ELP's material went through various stages of metamorphosis, you know. We did different arrangements of the pieces as we went along. So they did change over the years. There's two memories I have of Puerto Rico. One is rather horrible, and that is as we arrived there in the helicopter, they were taking out a dead body. Somebody had been decapitated in the festival grounds. Apparently some drug deal had gone wrong, and That was a horrific thing to arrive and see that happening.
My God.
And then I remember playing on the stage, and I had, at the time, I had a velvet jacket on, and they had these film lights, you know, like the spotlights, they shine up in the sky.
Right.
To illuminate the aeroplanes. One of these either side of the stage, and they were shooting them across the stage, and they were so hot, the velvet on my arm started to smoke.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it was so hot, I couldn't stand and sing, and I kept having to turn away from the microphone, and you'll hear on the tape my voice dropping out now and again. And it was because I had to turn away from the heat of this light. Every time they shined it on me, the heat became so intense that it started to literally burn my arm.
That is amazing.
I mean, these were the days when festivals were, you know, anybody could set one up, anybody could do it. They were flying helicopters in and out of there without any radar or control. It was just a matter of watching the blue lights to make sure you didn't hit one going in or hit one coming out. You're talking about Puerto Rico, a swamp in Puerto Rico.
My gosh. Of course, the High Voltage
Festival. A swamp in Puerto Rico run by drug barons, you know. It was a strange environment. However, the audience, of course, were all lovely people, and they'd flown down there to have a great time, and the actual playing side of it was beautiful, and as so many of those festivals are and were, the public, of course, never see the behind-the-stage madness and craziness that goes on, and people fighting and squabbling over which order they're going to perform in, and
Yeah, people running over in their time, all those things, yeah.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I could tell you stories that make your hair stand on end.
I love it. Salisbury Cathedral, what will you be singing?
I'm going to do I Believe in Father Christmas.
That was kind of a given, I guess, wasn't it?
Well, it was pretty much a given. I'm going to do Lucky Man, which is another given. And I'm going to read 'Twas the Night Before Christmas.
Mm. Now, will that be recorded? I'd love to hear that. And, of course, I won't be able to make the show.
I'll see if I can arrange for a personal recording to be sent to you, Bill.
Oh, bless your heart. I'd love that.
I'll try and do it. I'd have to see if what they've got going there. If I can, I'll knock one out for you.
Okay. I won't hold it against you if you can't pull off the miracle, but if you can, that would be wonderful.
Sure. Okay.
Now, I Believe in Father Christmas. What was the motivation behind that? What's the story on that?
It was a song I had written, a guitar lick, and I really didn't know. I mean, it was the basis of a song, but I didn't know what the song was about. I just had this little descending guitar lick, which you'll hear starting off the song. And one day it occurred to me that the tune of Jingle Bells fitted over the top of it, which gave me the idea of it becoming a Christmas song. And at the time I was working with Pete Sinfield, who I worked in, we wrote a lot of the King Crimson material together. And I said to Pete, I've got this song that I think could be a Christmas song, you know. And at first he said, nah, we don't want to write one of those, like, party songs, Christmas party songs. And I said, no, it's not like that. It's got a different feel to it. And I played it to him. And we started to talk about Christmas and how Christmas, when we were children, that it was all full of goodwill. And, you know, the whole thing about Christmas when we were children was peace on earth, goodwill to all men, you know, bury the hatchet with your neighbor, go and see the lady is all right, old lady up the road has got something at Christmas, you know. There was all that stuff. But as we became older, it just became about shopping and present buying and marketing. And we thought, that really is not what Christmas is about. And so we decided to write quite a serious song about how Christmas had become degraded.
Right.
And it was meant to be an album track, and it was meant to be quite serious. And that's why it had the orchestra on it. There was no question about it being a pop song or a hit record or anything like that. It was never meant to be a single. And it was only much later, when it had already been on the album, that I get a call from the record company, and they said, look, you know, we're going to release this as a single. And even then I said to them, you're crazy. How's that ever going to get into the charts? It's an orchestral thing. And they said, well, no, we think it will. It's, you know, it's got a catchy thing and la, la, la. And sure enough, they released it, and it started selling in vast quantities.
So you just never know, do you?
You never know.
Well,
I mean, look, almost every successful record I've ever had or been associated with has been a kind of accident.
Really?
Yeah, in a way. They've never been, I mean, Lucky Man was never recorded with the view of becoming a single. Lucky Man was recorded with a view to becoming an album filler, to fill up some time on the album, because we didn't have enough material to go on the first album.
And you wrote that at what age?
I was actually, I hate to say, but I was 12 when I wrote that.
My gosh.
It was the first thing I wrote. When I first got a guitar, I learned four chords. It was D, A minor, E minor, and G. And I composed this little song. And it was Lucky Man. And I don't know why, but, and I never wrote it down even, but it stuck in my head. And I think it was just so well formalized when I wrote it. I was careful to make it right, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do.
I was complete. It was absolutely complete. And so when it came much later, many years later, the song had been just untouched. It was just as it was. And it stayed as it was. And in fact, at the time, Keith Emerson couldn't really play on it. He couldn't find a way to play on it. It was just a simple guitar folk song. And he actually went down the pub, and I recorded it with Carl Palmer. And I put the bass... first of all, we recorded with acoustic guitar and drums, and it sounded dreadful. And then I put a bass on it, and it sounded a bit better. Then I put another acoustic on it, and it sounded a bit better. Then I put harmonies on it, and it sounded quite a lot better. Then I put an electric guitar on it, and it sounded pretty much like a record. And then when Keith came back from the pub, we played it to him. And he said, wow, you know, that sounds great. Maybe I should play on it, you know. and I said to him, look, we don't really need any playing in the song. Maybe you could put something on the end, you know, like a little solo. And it just so happened that very day he had delivered in the studio the Moog synthesizer from Bob Moog. And he had just started to experiment with it, to find out how it worked. And the actual solo on Lucky Man is Keith trying to work out a thing called portmanteau, which is where one note swoops up to another. Like this. A boo-wee, 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 boo-wee. He's trying to figure out the time it took for one note to reach the other. And in between it, he was putting these little lines quite thoughtlessly. And when he finished, he said, okay, I'll try one. And as luck would have it, I had recorded the experiment that he did. I'd press the record button, and Eddie Offord, the engineer, looked at me and he said, is it me, or did that sound good, the thing that Keith just played? Or am I dreaming, or did that sound great? I said, I don't know, let's check it. We played it back, and that is the solo you now hear on Lucky Man. So I got on the talk back, and I said, do you know what, Keith? I think you've already got it. And he said, no, come on, I'll do a proper one, and blah, blah, blah. I said, no, I think we got it. No, I can do it better than that. And it just so happened that we only had, at the time, 8 tracks, and there was no more room. Either we lost the solo we'd done to do another one, or we kept the one. There was no other choice. We couldn't keep the one he'd done and do another one. And so after a while, I had to go out in the studio and talk to him and say, look, come in and listen to what you've done. He came in and he heard it, and that was the end of that. The game set, man, he realized it was a keeper.
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea that was the story behind that. I knew you'd recorded it. I knew from the tour that you and Keith did last year, you told a bit of that story.
Yeah, and that was how I ended up. And even then, it was just, it really was a song to fill up the album so that, you know, we had whatever it was. At that time, vinyl records had to be 19 minutes, blah, 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 per side, 20 minutes a side. And it was just so in order we could fill up the track so that we had the right amount of time. It wasn't until months and months later that it started to become popular in America and get a lot of radio play.
Father Christmas, that was kind of your first dalliance with an orchestra then, wasn't it? You played orchestral pieces.
I suppose it was, really. I can't remember, you know. My brain's not that good anymore. I mean, I'm... I could remember doing it with the orchestra. It was certainly the first time I'd ever been recording anything solo-wise like that, yes.
And then, so that's kind of the beginning of the ELP path down with the orchestra, for better or for worse.
That's right. And I think generally it was for worse, you know. I mean, it was the beginning of the end, really, for ELP. It was the landmark when the band started going in its own direction. You know, everybody started to splinter off. And that was the end of the era of the innovative, great ELP albums. After that, they were all very fragmented and ill-conceived, I think, even though we worked with some of the greatest producers. I mean, Mark Mancina, for example, is a genius and a lovely man and a great producer and a great musician. Keith Olsen produced Fleetwood Mac. Tremendous producers, but they just, in the context of ELP, the beauty of ELP was that it was judicial and creative within itself. Once we started to become produced by outside producers, it became, you know, everyone deferred to the producer, and it became a sort of product. It became someone's interpretation of ELP rather than ELP itself, expressed by the band itself.
Mm.
You know, and even though I was the producer, it was done within the band, you know.
Right.
The band were the creative and judicial energy.
And that was rather unusual for the time, was it not? To be a self-produced...
I suppose it was, really. you know, again, this was another accident. We were in the studio very quickly after the band had formed. And there was nobody had thought of getting a producer. And it was only because I knew more about recording because of my experience with King Crimson.
Mm-hmm.
And I was better at it, and I knew more about it, so I kind of just did it. I mean, well, we didn't even discuss it. I just did it. And it, because the album was a hit, from then on, it was, well, Greg will do it. You know, Greg will take care of that. And from then on, I produced the albums.
You mentioned
those early albums, I believe, were the real ELP, the actual original, creative, innovative work of ELP, Trilogy, Brain Salad, Surgery, Tarkus. These were the records that were really different.
That's true. Whenever those came on the radio, I love the old days when three notes in, even if it was the first time you'd heard the song, you'd know that's ELP, that's Tall, that's
yes.
Deep Purple, that's whomever.
That's right. I often say that, and that is true of that era. You knew who you were listening to real quick. You know, you wouldn't need to hear much of Jimi Hendrix to know who you were listening to.
Right.
You know, whereas today, you could be quite a long way into a record before you really know who it is.
Right, because they all have that, they're overproduced, and they all tend to me to sound very much the same.
Yeah, because they're all using the same everything, and they really also, you know, the real truth of it is, there was a cultural inspiration, and it was the baby boomer generation. You know, right after the war, those babies were born, and they all grew up and became teenagers. And it coincided with the age of media, radio, TV. And there was this huge media and cultural explosion. And at the center of it was a youthful generation called the baby boomers. And there was a sort of awareness that had been hitherto shied away from or shut down, which was the sort of awareness of, I suppose it's best encapsulated by the Beatles, you know, all you need is love. That sort of opening your mind up to what really matters in life.
Very true. God, I love talking to you. You're so, you make me think about things in ways I'd never thought of them before.
I'm glad that is the way it is. But, I mean, all I'm saying to you is really what happened and what I lived through.
Right.
It wasn't what I invented. It wasn't what I created. I would just, I often say that is King Crimson, for example, as innovative and as original as that band was, when we were in it, it felt as though we were being blown along by a following wind. Everything was effortless, you know? Funnily enough, I talked to Ringo one day,
uh-huh.
And I did a tour with him, you know?
Right, it was awesome.
And I bought the book, The Best of the Beatles, just in case he wanted to play something, you know, from the past. And when I went into the rehearsal room, he had hold of the book. He'd found it in my wardrobe case. He fumbles around. He loves equipment, Ringo. And anyway, he said to me, "What's this? I haven't seen this book before." And I said, "Oh, it's the best of the Beatles, you know. I just got it in case you wanted to play something from the catalogue." And I said to him, "You know what, Rich? I said, I've been lucky. I've had a couple of hits in my life, a few hits. I said, but tell me something. How do you have 200?
That is the question, isn't it?
How do you have 200? Because, you know, they are truly hits. Every single song, you know, I know.
Oh, yeah.
If I say Eleanor Rigby, you could probably sing it to me.
You wouldn't want me to, but absolutely.
No, well, you probably wouldn't want me to either. But, you know, I'm just saying, there isn't a song that you could mention of theirs that you and I wouldn't know. And here's the thing. He said to me, "You know what, Greg?" He said, "Every day, John and Paul would come into to wherever we were. It could be a hotel room. It could be on a train. It could be in a taxi, anywhere." And he said they'd each have another song, and the songs would both be hits. And he said some days they had more than one. And that's how it was.
It's just
imagine. Every single day. Coming in, you know, here you are, Ticket to Ride. She loves you. From me to you. Help. Every single day. Just unbelievable, you know, but that is what happened.
That would be exhausting and exhilarating all at the same time, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, this is what I'm saying about a following wind. I don't think it was an effort for them. I don't think they had to go and sweat their guts out. It just felt natural, you know.
Mm.
They were carried along on a sort of magic carpet of spiritual movement, of power, and they didn't have to think about it. It was effortless.
Mm.
I mean, another person like that would be Bob Dylan. At his peak, he was whacking out songs that were just, Christ, where's it all coming from, you know?
Yeah,
where are all those great songs coming from? I mean, there's just too many of them.
I agree.
And that's the incredible thing about art and inspiration.
See, very well, Sissy. I'm far from an artist, so I can't begin to comprehend the creative process that you and Lennon and Dylan go through, but that's a wonderful insight into it.
Well, I'm just saying, I do believe you somehow hook into, more or less, this current, this moving current of creative energy. And if you think about it, music passes through the air, unseen, like a ghost, from one person to the other. So it is a fairly magical, weird thing to begin with. You see what I mean?
I do.
You know, one person thinks of it, and it goes through the air to the other person. I mean, what do you know that does that? Very little.
Very, yeah.
Yeah, and it actually moves the person on the other end of it. Can reduce them to tears. Can put a lump in their throat. Can make them feel like they're laughing and crying at the same time. You know, that's a weird property. So it doesn't surprise me when people say, oh, I had 200 hits. Well, yeah, you know, you obviously tapped into, very closely into that current, that raw current of creative energy in some way.
A little bit more before I let you go. You've been more than generous with your time, as always. Your autobiography, it's going to come out roughly the same time as your tour?
Yes.
Okay. So, do you have a title for it yet?
I'm hesitant to say it because until the biography is absolutely finished, you know, just in case something comes, I really don't want to say yet. But, yes, I do.
Fair enough. Okay. Excellent. We'll be able to go to the tour and get an autographed copy of the book.
Well, I hope so. Yes. Yes. But more importantly, I think the thing is to experience, hopefully, the story in real time. You know, that's my intention.
I don't recall this ever being done by anyone, just kind of opening themselves. I mean, you've always opened yourself up very freely. But to tell your story in this type of a venue.
Do you know, now you come to mention it, I'm not sure that I can think of anyone who's done it either. It's a strange thing because it's not that I had any great sort of overwhelming moment of, oh, Christ, you know, I'll do that. But now I come to think of it, I just don't know anybody who's done it, no. Mm. I don't know why. It seems like an obvious thing to do, really. Maybe it's something to do with my age and the fact that, you know, I am coming to the end of my career, but I'm not at the beginning of it. And so, you know, you have to be at the end of it to be able to do this.
Right.
Age is a component, you know.
Right. Justin Bieber's
I couldn't have done it 10 years ago, for example.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure as always, Greg, my friend. It's... just love speaking with you, and I'll see you in Los Angeles.
Good, I look forward to it.
Okay, just...
I'll see if I can capture a little recording from the Salisbury thing for you if I can.
That would be great, thank you. My wife's looking for it. My wife's carried a torch for you for 40 years.
Oh, well, there you go. Please give her my very best wishes for a great Christmas and a happy new year.
Right back to you, Greg, to you and yours. Thank you so much.
See you, Bill. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, mate. Bye.